Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Religion Report. I'm David Rutledge, and this week we're looking at freedom of expression in the religious context and the resurgence of blasphemy, which people once thought had been consigned to history in the modern West, but is making something of a comeback as the 21st century unfolds. We're going to be hearing from Dr. David Nash, a historian from Oxford Brookes University in England, who's also the author of a number of books on blasphemy and secularisation. Blasphemy is defined in Christian tradition as any form of speech or action that profanes the name of God. But David Nash distinguishes between two kinds of blasphemy. One is what he calls active blasphemy, which causes offence to the religious sensibilities of individuals. The other is passive blasphemy, which is perceived as an affront or indeed a threat to entire communities. And while passive blasphemy has its roots in medieval societies, where the community was seen as the basic unit of social organisation, David Nash believes it's on the rise in the modern West. As multiculturalism brings different religions into closer and closer contact, people often respond by investing more in their communal religious identity, with the result that religious offence becomes a communal matter rather than an individual one. If I'm offended, all my co-religionists are as well. So how does the notion of blasphemy sit with our cherished ideals of enlightenment and freedom of expression and social progress? And how should Christians respond to the challenges that blasphemy presents? Well, Dr. Nash was in Australia earlier this month, and he gave the keynote address at a conference on God, Freedom and Nature, hosted by the Catholic Institute of Sydney. And today we're hearing an edited version of that talk. Here's David Nash.
As well as work on blasphemy, I've also done some tentative movements towards writing a book on secularisation and secularisation theory. And one of the things that prompted me to do this was also holding the idea of blasphemy up to the issue of secularisation. Now, as we know, secularisation theory in various forms suggests that the modern world is more secular than the pre-modern, and this in turn more secular than the medieval. Now, one of the things I've noticed about some secularisation theory, particularly when it was written in the 1960s, is its almost evangelical tone and its assertion that religion was to be replaced. Also interested, I always remember one particular writer describing education as having been, this was in a supposed piece of sociology, education having been liberated from religious influence. But secularization's account of the historical past suggests that episodes such as the Reformation, the rise of Protestantism and the Enlightenment constitute irrefutable milestones towards the creation of this secular society. But blasphemy's history contests this series of assertions and offers a significantly different chronology for religious history. Certainly, we might be able to argue that blasphemy itself is a secularization of the idea of heresy. Heretics were quite regularly cast as victims of their errors, these errors entering their minds unwittingly. Most medieval and early modern accounts of blasphemers see them as willful individuals indulging their own pride. And certainly the investigation of early modern Germany, France, and Switzerland would lend credence to this view. The offence of blasphemy became one of active commission, whereby doubts or errant opinions were actively vocalised. In contrast to heresy, blasphemy was increasingly considered to be a lapse of discipline rather than sincere religious error. Nonetheless, other assumptions of the secularisation account do not fit with blasphemy's very different history. The Reformation, far from diluting the sacred, shifted the focus to Scripture and the Bible. A new light is also shed on this through noting how medieval conceptions of sin and shame equally had their later Protestant counterparts. The Enlightenment, it might be argued, brought philosophical and later artistic questioning of the sacred and its place in society. And this would fit with the history of the offence in England, where French Revolution ideals were later replaced by arguments about free speech individualism and the removal of religion to the private sphere. Nonetheless, such a triumph was not linear, nor was it remotely complete, since the link between church and state was never overthrown. Secularization theory itself has also never been comfortable in measuring Christianity's vibrancy within the realm of the private, preferring to see this as the story's conclusion. It's always interesting when the statistics mentioned in England, or rather Britain, is that each week six churches close, but six open. And the six that open, you don't see them because they are house churches, or one evangelical congregation I know of in Oxford. You talk to them about the church, and their description of the church is a gathering of people. They have no conception of buildings. They actually describe themselves as having been liberated from the issue of having to maintain a building. So they meet in warehouses, cinemas, wherever is available. And recent history for us has shown the sacred as capable of being mobilised precisely from this area with a rapidity that would astonish the previous generation. For secularisation, more damning evidence still comes from America, where an institutionalised cleave between church and state did not remove the concept of blasphemy from this society. Nor did the Constitution actively secularise American society, forcing religion into the private sphere. Even where it might be claimed that religion was successfully privatised, the conclusions we might draw from the evidence do not support components of the secularisation thesis. Religion becoming a matter for the private conscience occurred at precisely the same time as knowledge of the law and access to it became a real possibility for more individuals in the West. Secularisation argued that tolerance would be bred by greater contact between individuals, and that globalisation would homogenise religious outlooks and lessen differences between faiths and groups. And this confidence has not been borne out by the evidence of the late 20th century that's seen blasphemy reached for by individuals as a tool capable of preventing the erosion of the sacred. For some individuals and groups, defending religion has rejuvenated nationalism in the face of the twin agendas of globalisation and, in particular, pan-European systems of morals and justice. So secularisation theory clearly does not offer any valuable framework to explain blasphemy's history and its persistence. But it's actually possible to go further and argue that blasphemy's own history provided important material for a wider history of the sacred. Its persistence and its current relevance supply evidence of the survival of the sacred, not simply as a spiritual legacy, but as a vital component of beliefs about nationalism and wider identity. So when we look at contemporary issues, what I'm now starting to suggest to you is we're seeing something of a return to the passive medieval model of passive blasphemy. So even if religion appeared to be no longer secure within its earlier institutional base, its meaning to individuals remained significant. And incidents around blasphemy have often reacquainted populations with the legacy of their religious pasts. It's fascinating to see how a blasphemy case is, for many people, the way in which they learn about their religious traditions. The weakness of institutional churches when confronted by blasphemy has also given the initiative to concerned members of the laity who rail against inaction and ineffectiveness. Certainly one of the leading evangelicals in England, a gentleman called Stephen Green, quite regularly attacks the established churches for not standing up and being counted when they see instances of blasphemy. Although Western states had originally been interested in religious conformity and were prepared to convict and punish accordingly, the 20th century saw government and judicial enthusiasm for this collapse. Blasphemy laws then entered a legal and cultural limbo in which their use was only occasionally contemplated, but they were a sort of reassurance against moral and cultural disintegration. And this was true for both indigenous communities and immigrant communities who used these issues to build walls around themselves. What's striking is the different reaction shows how times have changed. I'll give you two examples of two different legislatures who had to think about the issue of blasphemy. In the early 1990s, the first of these is the Law Commission of New South Wales, which was very confident about abolishing the law. It could see no reason for a blasphemy law to be retained and argued that it was ostensibly a form of special pleading on behalf of religious groups. So there was a real sort of liberal confidence that blasphemy should be repealed. But it's worth comparing that with the Select Committee on Religious Offences of 2003, the House of Lords, the higher chamber of the British legislature. All it could do was really throw its hands up in horror after much deliberation and say that it could not recommend repeal, it could not recommend extension. And the very fact that the commission had met in the first place instinctively meant it also couldn't recommend the status quo.
On ABC Radio National, this is the Religion Report. I'm David Rutledge, and this week we're hearing a lecture given in Sydney earlier this month by Dr. David Nash, historian and author of Blasphemy in the Christian World.
Now, although the common law of blasphemous libel was repealed in England earlier this year, it's unlikely to bring the cultural phenomenon of blasphemy and feelings and the feelings of individuals being blasphemed to an end. And already it's clear that individuals and lawyers are investigating other offences, notably obscenity, to see if these can be used to protect beliefs. The tolerance of the post-war world relied upon a balancing act between the idea of freedom and responsibility. But by the end of the 20th century, this has come to an end. From the 1990s onwards, blasphemy frequently appeared as a tool grasped by individuals to defend religion and the legacies of its past. And as I've said, this has provoked discussion in countries like the Netherlands. You talk to some Dutch people who actually feel that their multiculturalism, their trust, has been betrayed by religious groups. And one of the leading arguments amongst Dutch academics in this particular area is, on the one hand, one group wants to persist with their view of multiculturalism, but another group argue that multiculturalism has failed and what you need instead is a secular state on the French model. In America, questions have turned around the security of the First Amendment and quite whether Christianity could be regarded as the country's official religion, even if it was never its established one. But I'd like to ponder precisely what the future holds for blasphemy's own relations with the sacred, because religion remains potent as a substitute for ideology and as a building block of identity to resist everything from unpopular laws to seemingly unstoppable phenomena like globalization. In this, many religious groups who associate their beliefs with species of identity are rejuvenating the ideal of religious community, which is also giving something back to the revival of the passive blasphemy model of the earlier phase of the medieval period. To maintain blasphemy as a vibrant working presence within active belief is to deny many of the tools and manners of artistic expression. And I can perhaps possibly demonstrate this by thinking through what happened with a particular West End show which went on in England a year and a half ago. Don't know whether it made it to Australia. Did Jerry Springer the Opera make it here? No one's seen Jerry Springer the Opera? Oh, well, here we go. Now, the evangelical Christian community took this production very seriously. Now, most people remembered, certainly when I saw it, the most memorable part of it was the closing scene towards the end of the first half, where there is a group of tap-dancing Ku Klux Klan members. And if you can just imagine people in the white gowns tap-dancing, you probably can't, but believe me, I saw it. But what brought the show real opposition was its depiction of Jesus, God, and Satan as three such guests on a Jerry Springer show, seeking a closure of the battle which had scarred the universe for the past 2,000 years. Christ, suggesting he was actually a little bit gay, was berated by Springer and by his mother Mary, who chastised him for having abandoned her through his death on the cross. God was portrayed as occasionally doubtful and possibly in need of the sort of therapy Springer traditionally peddled on his show. Now, many Christians, but especially the group Christian Voice, saw this last aspect as particularly offensive. It seemed clearly to suggest that Springer had been elevated to sit at the right hand of God. And this seemed to be confirmed in the operatic chorus, which sang Jerry Eleison rather than Kyrie Eleison. But, you know, to just see that at face value is to have no sense of the ironic. No sense of the ironic at all. Springer, for all its profanities, obscenities, and larger-than-life grotesques, deserved to be considered as a little more subtle than many of its opponents allowed. Just as Monty Python's Life of Brian had damaged the credibility of the medieval and Christian epic film, so Springer dealt a paralysing blow to the ersatz camp neo-melodrama of Andrew Lloyd Webber's musicals. Now, the opera also satirised the quest for instant salvation and its achievement through the ministrations of Jerry Springer, who often repeated he was only a facilitator of the spectacle of confession. The opera's conclusion that there was no good, no bad, which Christian Voice took to be a symbol of amorality, further indicated the vacuousness of postmodern obsessions with spectacle. The massed choir singing Jerry Eleison was counted by objectors as a total of 8,000 instances of blasphemy. Jerry Springer, the opera, certainly demonstrated that there were new ways in which the religious could inspire. When the traditional religious figures were combined with characteristics of modern sensationalist television, it was clear that controversy would result. If religion was the last taboo, then productions like Springer could only be expected. But campaigns to stop such productions really argued the sacred should remain inviolable and possibly undiscussed. In the case of Jerry Springer, they also argued that Christians should not be driven out of public space if they sought to protect their own beliefs. And again, events like Jerry Springer also rejuvenated the passive blasphemy model at the expense of the active encounters of more recent years. The medieval conception of damage to the community through damage to the honour of God was here making a surprising comeback. As religious fundamentalists tore up the agendas of quietism and tolerance, blasphemy regained some of its power. And this partly explains the complaints made by the numerous individuals who had not witnessed Jerry Springer the opera. To know their God had been lampooned in this way was enough. In some respects, these communities also judged world events through the prism of divine providence. And such views have now returned, seeking to police thoughts and the nature of expression. Fundamentalists who claim ultimate protection for their beliefs and wish to see prohibitions upon even the production of challenging material are further reviving the passive model. In this, it becomes a blasphemy that the production of such material is even contemplated. And this echoes the medieval perception that blasphemous utterances should only be judged at face value. And such passive blasphemy arguably threatens art and expression, which, after all, depends on irony, on wit, on metaphor, and upon allegory. And Western society has not retreated from the idea that beliefs are beyond criticism. And this is clearly a culture war that will embroil the West in the near future. To take blasphemy seriously is to allow fundamentalist religion to triumph with its one-dimensional view of the world. This also invests the blasphemous with a seriousness that most of the time it simply does not deserve. Jerry Springer was ephemeral and could scarcely do lasting damage unless it was put up to do so by endless discussion of its virtues and vices. Basically, the tap dancing Ku Klux Klan members are more memorable than the rest of it. But this worry is not an idle concern. When I was reviewing a paper for the United Nations, it became evident that the International Declaration of Human Rights is under threat. Increasingly, it's going to take on a regional characteristic, diluting the overarching declaration. And blasphemy will clearly be something that will be treated differently in these regional codes. They will not protect blasphemy as a form of free expression. And we thus possibly enter a cold war of words. Since the 28th of March 2008, the UN Special Rapporteur will now be required to report on the abuse of freedom of expression. This invariably means that blasphemy will become once more the means and language of cultural battle. So, it is a crime, ladies and gentlemen, reborn. The history of blasphemy becomes circular as criminal codes are redrawn to include it and reflect it. This protection for whole communities takes us back to the passive blasphemy model. So if we leave it here, we're stuck with a situation where the religious are fearful and unable to enjoy their religious belief and fashion themselves into victims of popular culture. On the other hand, we have a climate of fear amongst artists, writers, and those that express opinions, whereby material that might offend remains unwritten, unspoken, or not created.
You're listening to The Religion Report on ABC Radio National. This week, Dr. David Nash speaking on blasphemy.
So, what are my suggestions for pulling us out of this situation? Number one, I think we need to think what laws are for. I noticed recently when I was reviewing this document for the United Nations that many commentators on Sharia law were adamant that the law was directly linked with their conception of God. For them, to criticize the law was directly linked with blasphemy. It was to commit blasphemy. So I think it's important here not to let the definition of blasphemy slip into being a defense of the law. Laws are made to help people live together, even if it is sometimes an uneasy peace. Laws are also made by men, even if they are inspired by God. Thus, they cannot remain beyond criticism, nor should they ever be beyond criticism. In 1745, the deist Charles Blount suggested that the laws are the summative opinion of the virtuous and enforced by them. And I think this is a very important thing for us all to remember. Secondly, I think religions perhaps need to reflect upon their own history of the discursive elements of belief. What is the function and purpose of religious tolerance? For whom is it intended and when is it appropriate? And certainly in studying the Christian religion in its various forms, I've been struck by how one of the central motors behind concerns about blasphemy is the precise nature of Christ. If we look back to the 17th century, we can clearly see how religious doctrines such as Socinianism and Unitarianism caused such problems. Unitarianism denied the divinity of Christ, and Unitarians were prosecuted for blasphemy and denied civil rights until the early years of the 19th century for precisely this reason. In the 20th century, we can see this dilemma written quite large with the various film, television, and written portrayals of Christ. We can think of what we might describe as the straightly portrayed divine Christs. Think of the Franco Zeffirelli film. To an extent, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. And yes, believe it or not, the Christ portrayed in the Sermon on the Mount scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian. But there are also problematic Christs, which see him struggling with humanity. The one I think of first of all in the mid-1960s was Dennis Potter's Christ in his play Son of Man, in which a deeply upset and troubled Colin Blakely would rail up at the skies saying, "God, God, is it me? Is it me that is the Messiah?" Thinking more modern times of Nikos Kazantzakis's and subsequently Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ, with the Christ in that film tempted on the cross by the vision of having a normal life, marrying Mary Magdalene and having children. Think also of the Christ portrayed in James Kirkup's poem, The Love That Dares to Speak Its Name, a gay, active homosexual Christ, again, deeply problematic. But once the humanity of Christ becomes a recognized possibility, these people and others might argue they're simply filling in the gaps that the four Gospels don't tell us about. In places, they might even be following the text itself. And one example often occurs to me about this. And certainly I saw this in my own village, which held a passion play last year to commemorate 1,000 years of the medieval abbey that's used to stand in the village where I live. And I was waiting for a particular part of the play because I like to see this particular part portrayed, to see what the individual is going to make of Christ. And what I always look for and think of is chapter 4 of Luke, verses 1 to 13, which is the symbol of Christ being tempted in the desert. And it was very interesting when it was done in this passion play, the devil, Satan, merely asked Christ whether he would want the food or would want the kingdoms of the earth. And very quickly, the actor simply replied, no. But both the King James Bible and the Jerusalem Bible both suggest there is a degree of inner torment. Christ is hungry when tempted by the offer of bread and is tempted by the offer of all the kingdoms of the earth. The fact remains that in the West, viewing the individual's interpretation of this episode and the whole life of Christ as open to interpretation itself is a fundamental part of religious freedom. Closing these freedoms down will take us wholly back to a passive blasphemy model, and arguably a model of passive religion, where ideas are accepted without question. Religions of the book must remain discursive, and attempts to stop this process must be resisted. Lastly, the original offence of medieval blasphemy was an accusation of individuals taking on God's powers or ascribing them to another part of creation. And this implies a remoteness from God that I think modern Christians would find somewhat odd. But as I've said, the link between blasphemy and medieval providence persists well into the 20th century and survives into concerns about the nation state. Yet if blasphemy will make us concerned and frightened and slaves to literal readings of all our cultural products, then this must threaten to rob Western culture of all its mechanisms and tools of representation. We will all be freed of ambiguity, of doubt, of metaphor, of allusion, of allegory and irony. And in my opinion, this is far too heavy a price to pay, because these are all the things that make the West tick. Just as religion will not wither as secularization advocates predicted, and indeed some of them actively wanted, similarly, the Enlightenment cannot be undone, nor can the power of religious tolerance that has bequeathed to all of us so much.
Dr. David Nash, reader in history at Oxford Brookes University in the UK and the author of Blasphemy in the Christian World. And that talk was recorded at the Sydney Catholic Institute earlier this month. And that's the program for this week. Thanks to producer Jacinta Patterson and technical producer Charlie McCune. We have a transcript on the website as well as streaming audio and podcast links. So just go to abc.net.au/rn and choose the Religion Report from the program list. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company this week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.